Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to TorahMediaAtlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.
It is October the 25th. We are at the end of Parshas Kisisa, page 514. So, Moshe Rabbeinu is now going to come down from the mountain after being up there for the last set of 40 days, having achieved complete forgiveness for the Jewish people, having gotten the second set of Luchos of tablets. He's going to come down with those tablets. What day is he going to come down on?
Yom Kippur.
On Yom Kippur. He also has been given from Hashem the Yud Gimel Midos, the 13 attributes of Hashem, of mercy, which we had before. And now the Jews are going to see Moshe for the first time since he's gone up for the third time to Har Sinai. Vayomer Hashem al Moshe, Hashem says to Moshe, Ksav lecha es hadvarim ha'ela, write these things down. Ki al pi hadvarim ha'ela, for according to these things, karati itcha bris, I have made a covenant with you, ve'es Yisrael, and with the Jewish people. So the simple meaning of this verse is write down the words of the Ten Commandments, which is what he's going to do. He's going to chisel them on these stones. However, the Gemara tells us from here that this is actually a commandment to write down the entire Torah. Now, the entire Torah had not happened yet, so it cannot all be written yet, but this is a general commandment to write down the Torah. The Gemara says from here, write down these words you should write down. The implication is there are other words that you are not allowed to write down, and that is the Torah Shebaal Peh, that is the oral law. The oral law, one is not allowed to write down the oral law. Only the written law is allowed to be written down, not the oral law. Today, the oral law is recorded in the form of the Mishnah first, and then the Gemara, the Talmud. And that is because, as time went on, for the first 1,000 years after the Torah was given, the Torah was remembered from generation to generation, handed down the written Torah in written form and the oral Torah in oral form, as it is meant to be. But towards approximately 1,000 years later, the Jewish people began to forget the oral law, and it was becoming increasingly difficult to transmit it orally, and therefore needed to be written down. But because there is a commandment to only write the words of the written Torah, not the oral Torah, therefore, even when it became necessary to write down the oral Torah, it was done piecemeal, meaning that they did the minimum amount they could do. And that is why we have first the Mishnah and then the Gemara. The Mishnah was committed to writing approximately the year 180, 190, somewhere in there, is when the Mishnah was committed to writing. The Mishnah is essentially the shorthand of the Gemara. It's essentially the abridged version. You can read the Mishnah, and by reading the Mishnah, you can remember volumes of the Gemara. There's many, many details that are included in the Gemara, which are embedded in the Mishnah very subtly, with extra words here, extra sentences there, that can jog one's memory to remember all the details of the Gemara. So initially, only the Mishnah was written down, because at that time, that was deemed sufficient for most people to recall the entire Gemara, the entire Talmud. But roughly 300 years later, that became inefficient, or insufficient, I should say. And at that point, it was necessary to write down the entirety of Torah Shebaal Peh, of the oral law. And therefore, around the year 500 is when the entire Gemara was put to writing. If you're wondering, why did it happen like that? Why was it first just the Mishnah, then the Gemara? This is the reason, because they didn't want to permit everything, because according to the Torah, you're not supposed to write down any of the oral law. So even when we needed to write down part of it, we were told to write down only the most necessary parts, that which would remind the scholars of the rest of the Gemara. When that was insufficient, then the rest of it was written down. Today, we do not hold back at all. We write down everything. Because today we say that we presume that our ability to recall is so weak, and our understanding of the Torah is so deficient, we need as much help as we can possibly get. And therefore, today we write down everything that we can. However, it is still considered to be laudable to memorize as much as possible, because that's really the way it was supposed to be. In its purest sense, the oral Torah is supposed to be memorized. And therefore, anybody who can do that, and only there are very few and far between people who can do that, but people who can memorize the pages and pages and pages of the Gemara, it would be better if they would. And therefore, for example, you have prizes awarded to boys who have begun studying Mishnah for those who can memorize the Mishnah. If they can memorize some Mishnayos, they're given prizes. Why do we encourage them to memorize it? We encourage them to memorize it because that's really in its pristine form. That's what it's supposed to be. It's supposed to be memorized. And that would be better off if we could possibly retain all of that in our memory. It would be better. Even before the Mishnah was written down as an official body, as I said, around the year 180, 190, somewhere in there, and even before the Gemara was written down, in around the year 500, there were still notes that were taken. There were notes taken prior to the time of the Mishnah and prior to the time of the Gemara, but it was never compiled into an official body of learning. It was a person, independently, if he needed some notes to remind himself of what his Rebbe said, he would keep his own notebook of a little bit of words here and there just to remind himself. But that was never an official body of work that all the Jewish people would consider to be the oral Torah. Once, first Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, around the year 180, 190, once he put the Mishnah into an official document, that's why he redacted the Mishnah. He didn't create it. People had various notes here and there. He brought it all together and put it into a uniform body. And later on, the same thing with Ravina and Ravashi, roughly 300 years later, in the form of the Gemara, they did the same thing. There were notes that were floating around. They got people together, compiled them, and we now have the Gemara. Any question?
Well, I'm just a little puzzled, or I'm surprised, because I mean, I've never studied Mishnah and Gemara, so I don't know any of the background or much of the background, but I always had thought, and even where it says, you know, write the words down and so on, that I had thought that the Mishnah was essentially what Hashem told Moshe orally, and that the Gemara was, you know, Rabbi so and so said this and Rabbi so and so said that. I mean, they weren't part of what Hashem told Moshe.
Right, so...
So you understand my...
Mm-hmm. The words of the Mishnah, the words of the Gemara, neither were said by Hashem to Moshe, the actual words. The words are all quoting rabbis. All the Mishnayos are also quoting rabbis, just like the Gemara is. The only thing is that the Mishnah is generally written as statements.
As what?
Statements. The sukkah may not be 20 amos tall. The sukkah must have three walls. The bracha on meat is shehakol. It's generally written as statements by certain people, including disagreements. One rabbi says X, the other rabbi says Y.
Even in the Mishnah?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
The Gemara is written as a conversation. The Gemara sounds like you're actually sitting in the Beis Medrash, in the study hall, with the sages. The Gemara is written as a conversation. That's why there's nothing like the Gemara anywhere else. You don't have in secular legal works, there's nothing like it, because the Gemara actually records the conversations, the back and forth, the give and take. And it literally trains you how to do it yourself, because you're reading them doing it. That's what you're doing over there.
That's throughout the ages.
Yeah, yeah, right. Yeah. So, but neither one are the actual quote of Hashem. The Torah is the actual quote of Hashem.
That's written.
Yeah, the written.
But Hashem did give the oral Torah to Moshe.
Yes, he gave the laws and the details, but not in the form that we have it. Not with the statements that are recorded.
So, if you study just the Gemara, not the Mishnah, would you know everything that's in the Mishnah?
Yes, because the Gemara has the Mishnah in it.
Okay.
The Gemara is actually, it's not a second volume. It's the Mishnah plus. So actually, when you're reading the Mishnah, you're actually taking those same words that are in the Mishnah are found in the Gemara too.
Okay. Now, if you were to write out the entire oral Torah, would it be as long as the written Torah?
It's far longer.
Much longer.
Far longer. It's much bigger. It's much, much bigger. The other thing with the oral Torah is that it also incorporates within it the applications throughout the centuries, which means that the Torah itself, along with the oral Torah that was given to Moshe, did not say that one is not allowed to turn a light on Shabbos, a light bulb. It said one may not light fire on Shabbos. One may not build on Shabbos. The application, the rabbis had to decide how to apply both the oral and written Torah for modern day, not just modern day today. Modern day could be 500 years ago also. It was modern compared to what came before it. So as things changed and things happened, and it didn't have to be inventions. It could be simply circumstances the Jews found themselves in exile. What do they do now about the new moon? They didn't have the ability anymore to have witnesses come to court. What do they do? So we know what they did. They created a set calendar. That's not because of technological advancement. That's because circumstances forced the Jewish people to do something, and it doesn't say in the Torah what to do, so they had to figure it out. So all of the applications of all the new ages and new circumstances are incorporated into the oral Torah. So that today, the oral Torah is much longer, and with every passing generation, it gets longer and longer because there's more applications that need to be filled in.
So
they're not written into the Gemara. The Gemara is a fixed body. That's done.
Okay.
But as you move on, you want to study, let's say you want to study about sukkah. So sukkah is a pretty clear thing. How many walls it has to have, and the schach, and whether you know where it can be located, and how high it can be, how many, all the different details. So then the Gemara discusses some interesting types of cases. Fine, end of the Gemara. Now you come to our day and age, and there's a material called fiberglass. Can fiberglass be used for the sukkah or not? Well, it's not going to say that in the Gemara anywhere. So the poskim, those who rule, the sages of today, have to tell us, how do you apply that? And now it's not written into the Gemara, but someone who wants to study about sukkah, if they don't study what the modern-day applications, they're lacking. Because that's going to teach you something about how to apply what was completed 1,500 years ago today. Right? So it's dynamic because you have to constantly apply to new circumstances and new inventions. It remains a constant, the Torah, the written Torah, the oral Torah. But how do we then apply it to new circumstances? That is dynamic.
So these are added on books that then you would know to do that research?
So the added on books are primarily in the form of responsa, of tshuvas. Because
that's separate from what...
Yeah, that's not the Gemara. That's throughout the ages. You can open up the responsa of whoever, of Rabbi Akiva Eger, of the Chassam Sofer, and you get a window into what they were dealing with.
So for something modern, how do you know?
So that can inform when you have something that has never been asked before, when you go back and see how they applied things in their day, that teaches you how to apply things in your day.
But somebody's already written it.
There's volumes and volumes and volumes of us, but there's always new things. There's going to be new things. There's new things today. There's going to be new things 10 years from now, 20 years from now, 30 years from now. There'll be new questions and new issues. The state of Israel. State of Israel is a brand new circumstance. It's not a technological change in the world, but it's a brand new circumstance. How do you deal with a state which is governed by Jews, but there is no king, there is no temple, and the Jews who are governing it are by and large not religious? How do you deal with that? That's a new question that had never been asked before because it never existed before.
So did they have an answer?
It depends on what issue there is. There's the issues of the army and taxes and all kinds of things that you can ask questions about.
Shemitah. So who has the answers?
You want to know if a question is asked today, what happens?
Yeah.
So if a question is asked today that no one has ever asked before, so what'll happen is that whoever gets asked the question, let's say it gets asked in Atlanta, Georgia, and no one's been asked the question before, so it lands in the lap of
you, the
Kollel. So the Kollel will discuss it amongst ourselves, and we'll come up with what we think is possibly the answer, or we'll come up with three or four possibilities. But most likely, we will not know for certain, in which case we'll bump it upstairs, which means we'll go to our Rebbeim. And either they will feel that they understand it well enough to say definitively what the answer is, or they will bump it upstairs even further. At a certain point, you're going to get this to either someone or a group of people, there's no one upstairs who's still alive. In which case, they're going to be forced to say what to do.
Mm-hmm. Does that apply to the, for example, the things that they're working on for Shabbat? Things that you can use that you couldn't use?
Yeah, you know, so that's
like a wheelchair.
Yeah, those sorts of things they do come into play. Yeah, that's dealing with technology. How to deal with technology is a whole discussion in and of itself, because technology is, how do you understand it? The verse says in Koheles, Ecclesiastes, "Ein kol chadash tachas Hashem." There's nothing new under the sun. The verse says there are things that appear to be new, but they're not. There's always something that you can find precedent for. So, you know, we have cars, they had chariots. You know, so one is mechanized, one had a horse drawing it, one had gasoline making
horse
it work.
Power. Cars have horsepower.
Horsepower, good. All right, so there's precedent. There's precedent. The question is how exactly to understand the precedent.
It's really fantastic.
Yeah. All right, but this is where the verse comes from, to write down the written Torah, but not the oral Torah. Yeah.
On the pasuk here, you mentioned chiseling into the stone. So the question I have is, who wrote on the tablets? In this edition here, you know, the he wrote is capitalized. Well, it's Hashem wrote.
Well, let's read the next pasuk. The next pasuk Chavches 28. Vayishamim Hashem, he Moshe was there with Hashem, arba'im yom va'arba'im laila, 40 days and 40 nights. Lechem lo achal u'mayim lo shasa, he did not eat bread, he did not drink water, so he did not eat or drink. He was like an angel. Vayichtov al haluchos. This is your question, and he wrote on the tablets Eis divrei habris, the words of the covenant, Aseres hadvarim, the 10. It doesn't say 10 commandments,
yeah.
The 10
statements,
utterances, right? Yeah. So the question is, who wrote them? So they capitalize the H of he because they're saying it is Hashem who wrote them, and that is correct. It is Hashem who wrote them. It is not Moshe. Moshe chiseled the tablets before he carried them, and he carried them up the mountain with him. But it is Hashem who wrote the second set of luchos, just as Hashem wrote the first set of luchos. Vayihi beredes Moshe mehar Sinai, and it was when Moshe came down from Mount Sinai. Ushnei luchos ha'idus biad Moshe, the two tablets of the law were in the hands of Moshe. B'rid tomi ahar, when he came down from the mountain. U'Moshe lo yada, Moshe did not know ki karan or panav, that the skin of his face shone, glowed. B'dabro ito, when Hashem spoke to him. Moshe was unaware that his face now radiated. It glowed, literally glowed, when you looked at Moshe's face now, you would actually see this shine. And it wasn't a subtle thing. It was brilliant. You'd look at Moshe, you thought you were looking at a gleaming jewel. It was literally shining like a bright light, which terrified the people. Vayar Aaron v'chol b'nei Yisrael es Moshe. And Aaron and all the Jews saw Moshe. The Torah singles out Aaron because of all people, Aaron you would think would be the one who'd be able to handle this the best, because Aaron of all the people was probably closest to Moshe in terms of level of greatness. Aaron was next, perhaps. So they saw Moshe, v'hinei charan or panav, and behold, the skin of his face glowed, it shone. Vayir'u migashas eilav, they were afraid from getting near him. They were afraid of him. He appeared like an angel. He was literally shining. And it was a little unnerving. Now, they all understood what was happening over here. Moshe had risen in his level of spirituality to the point where on the mountain he was like an angel. He neither ate nor drank like an angel. That was while he was on the mountain. Now that he is descending the mountain, he's actually bringing with him some of that spirituality. The mountain, although it was an experience that is now over, Moshe retains some of that spirituality that he had on the mountain. And it's shown. You can see it on his face. They were afraid. Now, why were they afraid? Wouldn't they want to get close to a person of great spiritual stature? Why were they afraid? We'll talk about that in a moment. Vayikra lehem Moshe. Moshe called to them. Vayashuv elav. They returned it to him. Aaron v'chol hanasiim bo'eda. Aaron and all the leaders of the congregation. Vayidaber Moshe alehem. And Moshe spoke to them. He told them the laws of the Torah. Ve'achar echein nigshu kol b'nei Yisrael. Then all the rest of the Jews came close. Vayetzaveim, and Moshe commanded them. Eis kol asher diber Hashem ito b'har Sinai. All the things that he was commanded from Hashem on Mount Sinai. Let's pause there for a moment. Now, there's a little bit of a problem we have to discuss. The pasuk in Chav Tesen 29. The structure of the pasuk is telling. Well, we'll talk about that in a moment. But before doing so, let me tell you what our sages say over here about these two points. The point that Moshe came down and his face shone, and the fact that Aaron and the people were afraid of Moshe. So first of all, the Gemara tells us, where did Moshe merit to have his face shine like this? Where did it come from? So we said generally it came from Har Sinai. But what episode on Har Sinai made it happen? So our sages tell us that it happened in the cave. When Moshe asked Hashem to show Moshe Hashem's glory, and Hashem said, you cannot see my face, whatever that means, but you can see my back. And he put Moshe in a cave. And then Hashem passed by, again, whatever that means. Hashem has no form, so what does it mean he passed by? But whatever that means, the manifestation is, he passed by. And he covered Moshe with, kiviyachol, so to speak, his palm. It says he put his palm on Moshe. So when he put his palm on Moshe, and then he passed by, and then Moshe was able to see Hashem's back. Again, we don't know what these terms mean. It's not literal. We talked about it extensively at the time. But whatever that means, when Hashem, kiviyachol, so to speak, put his palm on Moshe, that caused Moshe's face to glow. Now Moshe's face is glowing. He got it from the palm of Moshe, of Hashem. Now,
where did that happen?
On Har Sinai.
It was on Har Sinai.
Yeah, on Har Sinai, when Hashem told him the 13 attributes. Right. Now, we'll come back to this in a moment. One more point. Why were the Jews afraid of Moshe? So our sages say, I want to read it to you because of how poignant it is. Bo ure'e, come and see, kama gadol kocha shel avera, how great is the strength of a sin. Come and see just how damaging a sin can be. Sha'ad shalo pashtu yedehem ba'avera. Before the Jews involved themselves in sin, Mahu Omer. What does the verse say? It says, "Umare kivod Hashem," the vision, the sight of the honor of Hashem. Ke'esh ocheles berosh ahar, like a fiery, like a burning fire on top of the mountain. This raging fire on top of the mountain. Le'enei b'nei Yisrael, to the eyes of the Jewish people. The Jews were able to look and see the raging fire which represented Hashem's honor on top of the mountain, and they were not v'lo yireim, they were not scared. V'lo mizdazim, they didn't tremble. U'misha'asu es ha'egel, once they made the golden calf, af mikarnei hodo shel Moshe, even just from the glow of the glory of Moshe, hayu martiim u'mizdazim, they were trembling and falling back. The sin made the Jews incapable to withstand even the spiritual glow of Moshe Rabbeinu, which of course is much more diminished compared to the raging fire which represented the honor of Hashem on top of the mountain. So two things have happened here. Moshe has become elevated in his spirituality. On the mountain, he brings down with him, showing on his face, this level of spirituality which he did not have before. And he got it when Hashem put, so to speak, his palm on Moshe as Hashem passed by, so to speak, and told Moshe about the Yud Gimel Midos, the 13 attributes. So Moshe comes down the mountain greater than when he ascended the mountain. The Jewish people are now diminished from where they were before. So the chasm between Moshe and the people has increased due to the Sinaic experience, where you'll recall all the way back in the beginning, the Jews didn't want the Torah to be given only to Moshe and then Moshe tell it to them. The Jews insisted on being not just flies on the wall. They wanted to be there and be part of the experience of Hashem. Speak to us directly. Don't have Hashem speak to Moshe and we just are there as spectators. We want Hashem to speak to us directly. And Hashem says, if you want it, that's great. And remember, we had to separate for 3 days. We had to prepare ourselves for receiving the Torah directly from Hashem. And after only 2 of the 10 commandments, we couldn't take it anymore. And Moshe said, how could you reject Hashem? Hashem said, no, that's great. It's a wonderful thing. They're demonstrating their fear of me. But we were very elevated. For those 2 commandments, we were all like Moshe Rabbeinu. We all were, for temporarily, we were on the same level as Moshe. We heard the direct utterances of Hashem, just like Moshe hears the direct utterances of Hashem. We were able to see through Asplaklaya Amirah, through a glass that is not cloudy, as the Gemara says, comparing Moshe's prophecy to other prophets, to be able to see clearly. And we were able to do that. That was the highest level we reached. And at that point, the difference between Moshe and the rest of us was at its narrowest point. He was so much greater than we were. But we had all reached the level where we were approaching Moshe Rabbeinu, at least temporarily. But now, 120-something days later, after Moshe went up the first time for 40 days to get the rest of the Torah, we sin with the golden calf. He goes up for 40 days to beg Hashem not to destroy us. Then he chisels out a second set of tablets. It goes up for a third 40 days to get the second set and come down. We have been diminished and Moshe has been elevated. And there's a huge gap now between Moshe on the one hand and the rest of the Jewish people on the other hand. Yeah?
So is this shame and guilt?
No. Is that why they were afraid?
Is that the feeling of them now, which is separating them from Moshe?
It's possibly shame and guilt. It seems to be that when people are on a lower spiritual level, they can't handle the greater spiritual
right.
experiences. No, it's not just an emotional.
No, it's low self-esteem.
No, I think it's deeper than that. I think inherently a person can't handle it. It's too powerful. It's too much, irrespective of the person's confidence. They're just not able to handle that. Similar to what we find that it actually in this coming week's parsha in Vayera, we find that Hagar was when she ran away from Sarah in this coming week's parasha, she will have a series of four different angels appear to her, and she's not afraid because she was used to seeing angels in the house of Avraham.
Right?
It was something which she was used to. Where normally a person is an angel appear to them, they get scared. An angel is a scary experience. It's a frightening experience. But Hagar wasn't afraid because she was used to it. She was used to it. Now, so we have Moshe receiving this new spiritual height with this glow on his face. And it happens through the palm of Hashem. There's another place where we find that Hashem used his palm, again, whatever that means, he has no palm, but it's meant to conjure up an image for us so we can try to appreciate what's happening, where he used his palm on a human being, but it was not to the benefit of that human being, it actually diminished that human being. The Gemara tells us, when Adam HaRishon was created, Adam, he was very, very tall. He was gigantic. And his knowledge and breadth was immeasurable as far as we're concerned. He knew everything. He was literally the Yetzir Kapov of Hashem, which means the handiwork of Hashem, the work of his palm. That's what it says. But after the sin, it says, Vatashes alai kapecha. The verse says that Hashem, the way the Gemara says it in the imagery of the Gemara is, he put his palm on Adam and crunched him down. Pushed him down to a more human level, to what we're used to. Does it mean that he's literally pushed him down? What it means is that Hashem diminished the stature of Adam HaRishon. If you want to have a picture of that happening, picture a creation that you might have made, let's say with something that is that's malleable.
Clay.
And you made it very tall, and then you just pushed it down with your hand. Right? So that's what happened with Adam HaRishon. Here with Moshe, Hashem uses his palm, whatever that means, to cover Moshe, not to push him down, but to cover him so he will not be hurt when Hashem's glory passes by. And when he takes his palm off, something from the palm remains with Moshe. He now glows. That same palm that diminished Adam, it increases Moshe. Moshe now begins to approach the inherent greatness that was in Adam before the sin. The Jewish people, when we receive the Torah prior to the Egel Hazav, prior to the golden calf, had reached a level where we were similar to Adam, all of us were similar to Adam prior to the sin. When we did the golden calf, then we reverted back to regular human beings, which is post-sin. But Moshe never did the golden calf. Not only that, Moshe saved all of us. Hashem said to Moshe, I'll destroy the Jewish people. You'll become the new Jewish people. Moshe says, I don't want that. And Moshe begs for us and pleads for us and gets for us the second set of luchos. Moshe's self-sacrifice results in Moshe and Moshe alone not just remaining on the level of prior to the sin of Adam, but he is elevated to a stature that no Jew had been before, nobody had been before, other than possibly Adam. And that's where Moshe will remain for the rest of his life. He is now on this elevated status. The Gemara says that in all of us there is a neshama, there is a soul. That neshama shines, it glows. But because we are so entrenched in physicality, that shine, that glow of the neshama is dimmed, but it's there. A person who grows spiritually, that shine begins to push forth. That shine begins to rise to the surface. In no one does it burst forth like it did in Moshe. It will when we reach the time of Olam Haba, reach the time of Tchiyas HaMeisim, the resurrection of the dead, then the neshama, as the Ramchal Rav Moshe Chaim Tzadok explains, will burst forth and will show and glow. But in this world, no one has it burst forth the same way it did for Moshe. But there can be, on a much lower level, a certain shine, a certain glow that can appear on the face of a very pious person. In the Gemara's time, Rav Yochanan, the great sage Rav Yochanan, had a certain shine and a certain glow. It wasn't on the level of Moshe, of course, but it was something which was discernible to the point that the Gemara describes that he was once visiting a sage who was very ill, and he came to visit him, and that it was a very dark room, and he rolled up his sleeve, and there was a little bit of light in the room. Again, we're not talking about this bright lamp. That we're just talking about a little bit of a glow, a little bit of a shine that came forth from Rav Yochanan, which mimics on a very small level that which came forth from Moshe Rabbeinu. Moshe Rabbeinu, it was a radiance. It was bright. With Rav Yochanan, it wasn't like that, but there was something there, and it was tangible. You could see it. You could notice it. If you were in a dark room, you could see it. Sometimes you have something which glows, but if you're in a regular light, you can't see it. But if you go into a dark room, you can see a little bit of a glow. That's what it was with Rav Yochanan. Mm-hmm. And with Moshe, you were able to see in the middle of the day. It was this bright shine. The Gemara tells us, when you have this succession from Moshe to Yehoshua, Pnei Moshe ke Pnei Chama, the face of Moshe was like the face of the sun, Pnei Yehoshua ke Pnei Levana, the face of Yehoshua was like the face of the moon. It doesn't mean that Moshe's face was as bright as the sun, but it means that comparatively, relatively speaking, Moshe had this incredible radiance like the sun, Yehoshua had a diminished radiance, but nevertheless bright like the moon. It was there. It wasn't as terrifying as Moshe's, but it was there. It was nevertheless there. So this is a real thing, which in theory could happen to anybody who becomes pious enough, connected to Hashem enough, that their physical body becomes so subjugated to their spiritual soul, the soul is able to shine forth somewhat. And that's what happened here with Moshe Rabbeinu. Yeah.
Adam HaRishon had that quality, right?
Mm-hmm.
Would you go over that again? When somebody went into the Maras HaMachpelah.
Yeah, they went into Maras HaMachpelah. They went into the cave where the Adam HaRishon is buried. And there was
a glow.
There was a glow. It does say there was a glow. That's correct. I don't know that much more than that.
And that Eve?
I think you've mentioned it before.
Yeah, no, I did mention it before.
Yes.
But I don't know much more than that.
I just wanted to hear that again. Yeah. So maybe that too came from Hashem touching him. Maybe he had that before, right? There was
from the creation in of itself.
Being
Adam HaRishon, he was a being that we don't really appreciate. We don't really understand what it was. Now, there is something which has to be worked on over here, as I mentioned. In Pasuk Chof Tes, verse 29, it says, when Moshe came down from the mountain, and the two tablets were in the hands of Moshe when he came down from the mountain, and Moshe didn't know that his face was shining when Hashem spoke to him. It seems disjointed. What is the beginning of the verse coming to teach us? It was when Moshe came down from the mountain, and the two tablets were in the hands of Moshe when he came down from the mountain, and Moshe did not know that his face shone when Hashem spoke to him. It seems that coming down with the tablets was part of the Moshe's face shining. So that would be very simple if it were true that when Moshe put the tablets in the ark, his face would have stopped shining. Then we could blame it on the tablets. But that's not so. His face shone, as we're about to see at the end of this parsha, his face shone all the time. So it had nothing to do with holding the tablets. However, what the verse, I believe, is coming to teach us is if you want to know how did Moshe's face shine, it has to do with him having received the second set of luchos. And that goes back to Moshe begging forgiveness for us and receiving the 13 attributes from Hashem, and Hashem protecting him, and therefore that experience is what caused his face to shine. So it is connected to the luchos, but not holding the luchos, it's connected to his achieving the receiving of the second set of luchos.
I have a question about beredis. What tense is that? Is that present tense? I mean, or what? Why doesn't, you know, later on we have Berito in his descent. Is one of them a verb and one of them is a noun?
Well,
I mean, in other words, Beretis does not seem like a past
tense. Yeah, it's a noun.
In the descent of Moshe.
Yeah. Pasuk Lamed Gimel 33. Vayechal Moshe midaber itam. Moshe finished speaking to them. Vayitein al panav masveh. And he put on his face a mask. Moshe would wear a mask for the rest of his life. For the next 40 years, Moshe would wear a mask and only remove it at very specific times. Uvevo Moshe lifnei Hashem ledaber ito, and when Moshe came before Hashem to speak to him, Yosiras hamasveh ad say so, he would remove the mask until he came out. So he would, when Hashem was ready to speak to Moshe and tell him more laws, Moshe would remove the mask. First of all, it would not be appropriate. It would not be derech eretz. Hashem wants to speak to him. He's got this mask on his face. It's not nice. But moreover, the mask was to hold back that shine. Well, he's talking to Hashem. That's where the shine belongs. So he would remove the mask. Then v'yatza, he'd come out. V'diber al b'nei Yisrael, eshe yitzuveh, and tell the Jewish people what he was commanded. And while he was teaching Torah, the mask was off.
Oh.
The mask remained off from the time that Moshe heard the commandments of Hashem until after he then transmitted them to the Jewish people. He transmitted Torah with the mask off. And people would see the full shine and glory of Moshe. V'ra'u v'nei Yisrael's p'nei Moshe. The Jews would see the face of Moshe. Ki karan or p'nei Moshe, that his face was shining. Ve'yishiv Moshe as hamasveh al panav. Then Moshe would return the mask on his face and bo'o ledaber ito until he would come to speak to him again. So from the time he finished teaching the Jewish people until the next time Hashem spoke to him, the mask would stay on. So the Jewish people were only able to see that shine, that glow of Moshe, when Moshe was teaching them Torah. Why did he wear a mask? Why not leave it off all the time? So here we're going to have a very interesting point, which is worthwhile noting. A very, very interesting point. This, and we have another point to make before the end of today's class. The Rashi tells us, V'lichvod karnei hahod. It was for the honor of his shine, of his glow. Shelo yozonu hakol mehem. So that everybody shouldn't become satiated, shouldn't be able to enjoy the sight too much. Hayanos in Hamas v'keneg, that he would put the mask over his face. The reason Moshe put the mask on is so that people would not, they'd never have enough of it. They'd always want to see more. It wouldn't be enough. Something that gets covered, then people want to see it. Something that is always visible, it's boring. Nobody's interested anymore. V'kodesh HaKadoshim, the Holy of Holies, was an unbelievably beautiful place. The entire room was covered in gold. And you had the Aron, the Ark, with the Kruvim. I mean, it was an unbelievable sight. Only one man ever went in there, only once a year, and that was the Kohen Gadol on Yom Kippur. However, what happened if there was a leak in the roof? What if there was something that had to get fixed inside the Kodesh HaKadoshim? What if the Kohen Gadol went in there and noticed something that had to get fixed? So he told them about it. They had to send workers in there to fix it. So the Gemara tells us, how did they do that? So the Gemara says they would lower them down in boxes from the roof. Elevators. They lower them down. the boxes they would lower them in were closed on three sides and only open in front. So they could only see what they had to work on. But that's it. For the same reason. Because if it was completely open, if they were lowered on a scaffold or something like that, then they would like look around. Wow, that's unbelievable. Whoa, look at that, look at that, look at that, look at that. Right? The Kodesh HaKadoshim is not a spectator sport. It's not something everybody gets to look at whenever they please. And therefore, even when it was necessary to send someone in, he only got to see what he had to see. And that's it. Moshe Rabbeinu's face was not a museum piece. It wasn't something for everybody to go gawk at. It was something that was special, that was reserved for special times. The whole concept of tznius, of modesty, comes from this idea. And we're saying it in terms of covering and uncovering. Of course, that's tznius. But it's true about physical appearance. It's about what we have, our talents. And our talents are not meant to be shown off all the time for everybody to see. Talents are meant to be used when it's important to use them, but not when they're not ready, not at the time when they're not supposed to, not meant to be used. And that is the whole concept. And it diminishes the importance and the value of something when it's always out there. When it's always out there, it becomes ho-hum, big deal. When something, whether it's physical appearance or whether it's a talent, whatever it is, when it is reserved for certain special situations, it remains special. And when it's always out there, it becomes old hat. So Moshe covered his face so that the glow would not become old hat. Even his glow, which is just an unbelievable thing, imagine having the merit, the schus of seeing Moshe with seeing that glow. It's unbelievable. It's an incredible thing. But even that will become boring if it is out there all the time. So Moshe covered his face except when he was teaching Torah. That's when they saw the glow of Moshe. Now one last point, which is that the Gemara here, based on this on these verses, tells us the system from here on in that Moshe uses to teach Torah. Moshe would get a communication from Hashem, and we have to teach it to the Jewish people. He would first teach it to Aaron, and only Aaron, just Aaron. Then, so it would be Moshe sitting with Aaron across the table from him, and he would teach Aaron. Aaron would get up and go and sit on Moshe's left. So Aaron's on the left, Moshe's on the right. Then Aaron's sons would come in, Eleazar and Itamar. Now they would be taught by Moshe. Then after they were taught, they would get up, and one would sit on Moshe's right, one would sit on Aaron's left. Then the elders would come in, and Moshe would teach them. And then they would get up and sit on the sides. Then the rest of the Jewish people would come in and they'd be taught. So Moshe would teach it four times. Once to Aaron, a second time to Aaron and his sons, a third time to Aaron and his sons and the elders, and a fourth time to everybody, Aaron and his sons, the elders, and all the Jewish people. Then Moshe would leave. And now Aaron, who had heard it four times, would teach it to his sons, who now are hearing it for the fourth time, the elders, who are hearing it for the second time, the third time, and the Jewish people who are hearing it for the second time. Then Aaron would leave, and his sons, who now have heard it four times, three from Moshe, one from Aaron, they would teach it now to the elders and to the rest of the Jewish people. The elders are hearing it for the fourth time, the Jewish people are hearing it for the third time. Then his sons would leave, and then the elders, who have now heard it four times, will teach it to the Jewish people. So everybody ended up learning it four times. But Moshe taught it four times to Aaron. Three times to Aaron's sons, two times to the elders, and one time to all of the Jewish people. So you'll ask, why doesn't Moshe teach it four times to everybody? So it seems to me that it was critically important to give over the ability to transmit Torah to other people besides Moshe during Moshe's lifetime. Had it always been only Moshe, And as we mentioned, the rift between Moshe and everybody else is so great that when Moshe dies, it will be impossible for anybody to replace him. How is it possible? It's just, we've never had any training in any kind of teaching, of learning, other than through Moshe. There had to be a system put in place that trained the future leaders of the Jewish people. And this was the way it was done. Remember, the golden calf itself, which was before there was such a great rift between the Jewish people and Moshe, was because they thought that Moshe was irreplaceable. What do we do without Moshe? No human being can be Moshe. Now, that risk is even greater. How could there be a Moshe? So it was critically important that there be a system put in place that showed you can have other teachers. Yes, they're not going to be as great as Moshe, but other people can teach. It's not, Moshe eventually is going to die, and you're going to have somebody else. And yes, Yehoshua is great, but he's not Moshe.
Isn't Yehoshua mentioned in the beginning of Pirkei Avos in the chain of transmission? Is he not?
Yes.
So where does that fit in this?
In this thing? I assume he was with the elders, but I'm not sure. It could be he was there the entire time because he's the student of Moshe. It could be he's not even mentioned because he's always there. So it could be that, you know, that he's just
he's taken for granted.
Yeah,
the whole time.
Yeah.
So when you say he's teaching whoever's teaching at that time, are they teaching the written Torah or the oral Torah?
They're teaching both. Whatever it is that Hashem gave Moshe at that time. Because for the next 40 years, Hashem is teaching Moshe different laws.
Okay. Now, the written Torah that Hashem is giving to Moshe is actually written down on stone or whatever.
On parchment.
On parchment.
Okay. At the end of the 40 years.
Yeah.
At this point...
Oh, at the end of the 40
years.
Yes,
at this point...
Written?
Yeah, at this point, the only part that's written is up until the Torah is given.
Oh, okay.
After that... Then, as I mentioned before, there's a difference of opinion whether it was nothing more was written down until the end of the 40 years, or every time something else was taught, it was written in.
Okay, and then the other question I have is, I know there's no capital letters in the Hebrew, but there's no way when they say Moshe spoke to him, and to him is just like him is a suffix of whatever
right.
The word is. It's like not important enough.
Oh, I mean, how do you emphasize that? That's a good point. Yeah, okay, that's a good.
Why isn't it?
That's a good question. That you're asking, why isn't it emphasized in a way that you can tell that it's Hashem?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a good question. I don't remember the answer to you.
Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to TorahMediaAtlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.